We will begin. This is Robert Tidwell conducting an interview, an oral history interview, with Mrs. Susie McKeon, the wife of Chief Mike McKeon, who was a survivor of the collision between HMAS Melbourne and USS Frankie Evans on the 3rd of June, 1969. The time is approximately 15 after 10 on the 24th of August, 2007. So, Ms. McKeon, how are you this morning?
I'm fine, thank you.
Would you begin by telling me about yourself? Where were you born, where you grew up, and what was your childhood like, those sorts of things?
Okay. I was born in the Philippines in 1935, and during my childhood, it was a fun time, but then the Second World War started, and we missed out on education, because, well, I was in first grade at the time, and we had to go into evacuation from the city to the farm, and that went on for about 4 years, and we finally resumed school after the war was over, Second World War, that is.
Okay.
And then that life was hard after the Second World War, but we managed, and then I went to a nursing school in 1955.
Okay.
I was a student nurse when I met Mike.
Okay, while you were a student nurse.
Yes, I was a freshman at the Baguio General Hospital School of Nursing.
Okay. Where in the Philippines were you born?
I was born in Lawag, Ilocos Norte.
Okay. And is that, how far is that from, say, someplace like Luzon or
what? In Luzon.
Beg pardon?
That is in Luzon.
Oh, it is. Okay. Okay. And so how did you and your husband meet then?
I was a student nurse, and I was on vacation. And someone invited us to see Camp John Hay. It was an American base.
Okay.
It was where U.S. servicemen go for rest and recreation. And we had to have a pass to go there. There were eight of us. Student nurses, and the person that invited us or sponsored us to get in was sort of, I think he was embarrassed to be with eight girls. he invited Mike, who happened to be on furlough at the time. He was already in the Navy. He was with the USS P.E. Chandler.
Okay.
But he was home for just a few days leave, I believe. And we were introduced to him while we were in Camp John Hay already, touring the place.
Okay. And your husband was from the Philippines as well, wasn't he?
Yes, he was born in the Philippines also.
Okay. Was he born very far away from where you were, or not very far? Okay.
I think the province is La Union.
Okay. So you met him whenever you were among a group of other student nurses who...
Yes, there were eight of us.
Okay.
Eight student nurses. We were young.
And what year was this?
1955.
1955, okay. And so how was it that the two of you got together?
Well, he took some pictures. He said he wanted some souvenirs from our meeting. And he wanted to take some pictures and take it back to the ship with him, and he promised to send us some copies.
Okay.
And he did. And I asked him for... What happened was when we went to Camp John Hay, there was only one person invited to start with. But in the Philippines, it's a custom that when one is invited, you can invite other people. That was a custom. And we were tag-alongs. We just had to tag along. There were And then this person that was invited, we told Mike to send the pictures to her.
Okay.
And he did. And he did. He sent the pictures to this lady. Her name is Christina.
Okay.
Mike took a picture of me by myself, the only picture that was a solo picture, and I asked Christina to give me that picture or share some of the pictures that Mike had sent her. And Christina would not give me any picture. She just said, why don't you just write him and ask for the pictures, and maybe he'll send you some. So I did. I wrote him. And I asked him for just any copies he could send me. And then he said that he will look for the negatives. And then he said, can I have a picture of yours? He was asking for a picture from me instead. Instead of sending those pictures, he did not send me any. So anyway, to be friendly, I said, okay. I had a picture of me taken just recently. It was a picture of what we call a capping.
Okay.
Capping ceremony, capping picture. It's my picture to see that where I had the nurse's cap.
Oh, okay.
It's a location for a student nurse. And
so this was like a graduation photo.
Yeah, but it's not a graduation photo. It's a capping and candlelight photo.
Okay.
That's part of a student nurse where, you see, when you enter the School of Nursing, you just start with just the plain uniform, and then after 6 months, you have what you call a capping and candlelight ceremony, and they give you a cap that's a white cap.
Okay.
That's special in a student nurse life, and so I gave him the last copy I had, and that's how it started. And then we started writing each other. And then he every year he would come to the Philippines, and then he would come and see us, take us out, 8 of us. And we continued our correspondence through the years.
Okay. So how long was it from the time that two of you met and began your romance to the time that you married?
Well, at first the letters were just friendly.
Okay.
But then it was the Christmas of 1957.
Okay.
And he finally told me that he had been in love with me from the first day we met. He was just, he didn't want to be turned down. So he just kept it a secret. And we graduated in 1958.
Okay.
And before graduation, I told him I love him too.
Okay.
And so we got engaged in 1959, gave her a diamond ring, and got married in 1960.
Okay. So then when the two of you married, did you move from the Philippines, or did you stay there for a while?
We got married in 1960, and I came to the United States in 1962.
Okay. Where in the United States did y'all live at that time?
Well, I came through a military air transport.
Okay.
And we arrived in California.
Okay.
And a few months later, and he was aboard the USS Coral Sea, and that's where his ship had its home port.
Okay.
And then we moved to Washington State.
Okay.
Oak Harbor, Whidbey Island, where he was on shore duty.
Okay. And then when whenever he was stationed aboard the Evans, when did he first go aboard?
He went to the Evans in 1968.
Okay. And so y'all were, living in Long Beach at that time, or?
Yes, we moved to Long Beach and we stayed in the Navy housing.
Okay. So, when did you start having children? Did you have children fairly shortly after you all got married, or did you wait a couple of years, or?
Well, we had a child. The first born was in March of 1961.
Okay. Okay.
And she was born in the Philippines.
Oh, okay. And how many children did the two of you end up having?
Four.
Four children, okay. How many boys, how many girls?
Three girls, one boy.
So is the boy is he the oldest, the youngest, or is he somewhere in the middle? Or?
The youngest.
Okay.
he said he met you.
Ah, yes, I'd met him at the reunion here in Lubbock. So when was he born?
He was born. Mark was born on the 29th of May, 1970.
Okay.
After the Evans collision.
Wow. So that's not a bad distribution there. Having your first child born in 61, and then the last one born in would you say it was 1970? Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, there's enough separation between the children there. Especially for the oldest to hassle the youngest.
Yes, they were fond of him.
Well, I imagine that since he was the only boy, it was kind of interesting for him, especially being the youngest child and the only boy out of the group.
Yeah, he was spoiled by my husband. But I treated them equally.
So, at the time of the collision, when it actually occurred, what kind of news did you get? When was the first time that you had heard that there had actually been a collision, and how long did it take before you knew what had happened to your husband?
Hear about the collision from the news. I got it from a friend.
Okay.
That's actually, she was the wife of one of the chiefs aboard the Evans.
Okay.
And her name is Leigh Malilay.
Okay.
I worked that day and I came home, and when I got home, the phone was ringing and it would not stop. So I decided to answer it. And it was Leigh Malilay.
Okay.
And she told me, "Where have you been all day? I've been trying to get in touch with you." And I said, I was at work. And then she asked me if I heard the news. And I said, "What news?" And she said, "It's about our ship." And I said, "What about it?" And she said that you better take a hold of yourself, she told me. Said, "It's not good news. Our ship has been in a collision, and there's some men missing." I could not believe her. I said, "No, it can't be, because I just received the letter, and Mike told me he's fine, they're fine." And she said, "Yes, but you know, the accident happened today, and the letter you got was probably written last week." And then I was in denial. And then she said that it's all over, the news it's on radio, it's on the newspaper. And she told me to turn the television on, because they were talking about it right there and then.
Oh, wow.
And I, I turned the TV on, and sure enough, they were talking about the USS Frankie Evans having collided with an Australian aircraft carrier, and there were helicopters on the screen, TV screen. They were looking for survivors, and that they said that there, some men were missing. And I was just stunned. I did not know what to think or say or what. I just sat down and just felt like I was limp. And the kids were just playing around, and then they noticed that I was not reacting. I mean, my mind went blank, and they said, "What happened, Mom?" Because they were looking at the TV too, and I said, "Daddy's ship was damaged, or something happened to Daddy's ship." I told them. I tried calling the newspaper. I called the newspaper. I called the base to find out what happened and who were this dog, if everybody was saved or nobody died or whatever. But they didn't have it. There was no information. I could not get any information.
Okay.
Other than some men were missing. And that went on to the next day. And I don't remember now how many days before I finally found out if Mike was okay or what. But what I remember was they had names. They had the names of people missing. That's what they said. The press telegram told me that they have the names of people missing, but they were not really giving out any information. And I asked them, "Is his name in the missing list?" And they said no. So that's all the information I got. But at least when they said no, I knew that he was alive.
And I bet you were very, very relieved at that point.
Yes. And then we were told that we were going to have a meeting at the house of the ex-host's wife. I mean, the executive officer.
Okay.
The wife was going to be there, and Mrs. McLemore was going to be there. Mrs. McMichael was the wife of the executive officer. So we went to their house, and they told us that Chief Riley was going to be calling.
Okay.
So we did get a chance to talk with Chief Riley.
Okay.
I did get a chance to talk with him, and he told me that my husband was injured, and he had to be taken to the hospital in South Vietnam. I asked him how bad was he injured, and he said that he suffered some burns because he was on duty at the time in the engine room, and that's where the collision happened, or where that's where the ship was cut in half. And then he also said that he was also wounded and he had a hairline fracture in his neck.
Mm.
So we only had to talk briefly because that's the time allotted for his call was limited. So at least he was alive. I knew he was alive. I knew he had some burns and that he was taken to a hospital.
So what was your reaction when you discovered in this conversation that he was injured? Were you concerned?
I was relieved because he was alive, and yet I was worried because I didn't know how the extent of his injury and how bad he was. So I thought I would get some information later, and I did. There was an officer that came to the house later on. I think that was 5 days, 3 days after the collision.
Okay.
And when he came in, and when he came knocking at the door, I was scared because Mike had told me during our honeymoon that if something happens to him, somebody would come and see me.
Sure.
And I thought that he had died.
Oh wow.
And I opened it, and he was in uniform. This officer was in said, no, no. I said, I thought he had died. I told him he was alive, that he survived. And he said, and I think I was so nervous. He said, yes, he survived. It's not what you think, he said, because I think he knew that I was thinking that he had died. It's not what you think, but sit down, he said, because I think I was already passing out. So we sat down, and he said, your husband survived, he said, but he had serious injuries. And I said, how bad was his injury? And he said, he had first and second degree burns.
Oh, wow.
And he was, it was 42%. So I said, oh, 42% and first and second degree burns. That's really serious.
That's very serious, yes.
Yeah, very. But I've taken care of burn patients before, and that's a serious injury. And then he said that he also suffered some cuts because they had to escape from the engine room. And also, since the ship was cut in half right where they were, there were some debris that they had to, it cut them somehow. And he had some wounds.
Oh, wow.
And he was taken to Cameron Bay.
Okay.
U.S. Air Force Hospital.
Oh, okay. So you take to an Air Force hospital.
They airlifted him.
Okay.
And then he said that they would keep me informed of his condition or keep me updated on his condition as the days go on.
So what did they do? On a daily basis, just say, yes, he's still okay, or if there was any kind of change, then they would tell you?
They sent me a cablegram. I think that's what they call those days. They had a cablegram. They sent me three, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
They sent me three cablegrams. First, they informed me that he was on the USS Kearsarge.
Okay.
That he had survived, and then I also received a cablegram from Mike that he said I'm okay. Yeah, I think all the guys were allowed to send cablegrams.
Okay.
And then another one was I was told about the extent of his injury.
Okay.
And then later on he progressed to where he was more stable, and then they said that his condition is now stable, and that I will not be hearing from them anymore.
Okay.
I think this came from the Bureau of Naval Personnel.
Okay. So how long was it before you were able to see your husband again?
I believe it was over a month
after
the collision. They airlifted him from Cameron Bay to the Oakland Naval Hospital.
Okay.
San Francisco area. And I went to see him there.
And so, when you first saw him, what was your reaction?
He was in therapy, and I waited, because they said that he was going to be finished with his therapy shortly after I got there. And then I waited outside, and then shortly after that I saw him coming. He was in a bathrobe.
Okay.
And he was walking like funny, because what I mean by that is he was not so stable in his walking like normal.
Okay.
He was walking protectively.
Okay.
And when he saw me, he had a big smile on his face, and I did too, and we hugged, embraced tightly, and I was crying. We both did. Because at least he was alive. He was undergoing physical therapy because of the burns and contractions in the arms a little bit. He like I said, 42% from his legs to his face.
So when the two of you were able to actually see each other again face to face, how long was that meeting? Was it just, did they allow you just a few minutes to talk to him, or were you all able to spend a good deal of time together?
Oh, I spent the whole day, the whole afternoon with him.
Oh, wow.
Afterwards.
So what did you all discuss then?
Well, he asked me about the children, and we didn't really talk much about the collision, just a little bit about the collision. Like
okay.
He said, he told me that some of the men did not survive. That there was somebody in his section, son of Chief Riley.
Okay.
Did not survive. That he died. And it seems like he was having a difficult time talking about the collision.
I imagine so.
Yeah, very difficult. So I did not push it at first. He told me later, and when he finally got home. Finally told me more about it.
So how long was it before he was able to go back on duty and go back home? And
I think he was up for less than 6 months.
Okay.
They were going to send him back to a ship, but I wrote the Bureau of Naval Personnel and asking them not to send him back to the boiler room.
Sure.
Because he had nightmares often when he was home. I had to wake him up because he would be making noise like he's scared. And then I knew that he was not ready to go back to the engine room. We assigned them. So they assigned him to do quality assurance, like he would go and go visit some of the Navy ships and evaluate their the situation, I guess.
Okay.
So, but he did go back to a ship later on. I think, let's see, less than a year he was stationed to the USS Hector.
Okay. And what kind of ship was that?
USS Hector? I don't remember.
Okay. Well, I was just curious if they'd sent him to another destroyer or if they'd sent him to a larger ship.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So a year later, they did place him back in a ship. Was he in the boiler room again? Okay.
He was back there again, but he told me that he tried as much as possible. He'll only go there if he had to. He was just, you know, it's a feeling.
Sure. So, how long did he stay in the Navy after the collision?
The collision was in 1969.
Mm-hmm.
And he was on the USS Hector until 1971, I think, or 72. He went on shore duty after the Hector. And he retired in 1974.
Okay.
April 1974. He retired from the Navy after 21 years.
Oh, wow. Okay, you said that after some time had passed after the collision that he was able to open up a bit more and talk about it. So what were the things that he said about it? How did he start talking about it to you?
Well, I asked him what happened, and he said that he was on duty that night of the collision. He was in the forward engine room.
Okay.
And they were steaming fast.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden he said there was an order from the bridge to pull back down. That's one of the words I did not understand at first, but I found out later on pull back down if you go fast and reverse.
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying that you just don't get that type of order, like you're going fast, and then right away you have to pull back down, and then shortly after that there was a crash. They heard it was just moments, he said, when they received that order. And then, but he had, when they received that order, he thought there was something wrong. Why would they order something like that in his mind? And I think they tried to do the order, to carry out the order, but shortly after that there was a big crash, and it was like a metal, grinding metal, he said. And it was right through the engine room. It went right through the space. And he was thrown into the bulkhead. And then something fell on him.
Oh, something fell on him?
Yes.
Okay.
And it pinned him down on the neck area.
So he received a lot of injuries then. I mean, one being burned and then being thrown against the bulkhead and then something falling upon him.
He tried to free himself, he said, but that thing that fell on him, it would not move. And meanwhile, there were overhead, the steam pipes they got broken, and it was releasing superheated steam, and he felt himself being burned. But then when the water from the sea started rushing in, it relieved him from the burning sensation that he suffered. But then the water kept rising, and pretty soon he was underwater.
Oh, wow.
And he thought he was going to die because he was drowning. And that's when he thought of us and prayed. He said he prayed, God, if you can hear, please, if I'm not going to make it, take care of my family, he said.
Sure.
And then shortly thereafter, the position of the ship shifted. It went back to its normal position, and because it seems like when the accident happened, the ship got turned to its side.
Mm-hmm.
And then he got up. When the ship went back to its right position, he was able to get himself free from that heavy object that had pinned him down.
Oh, wow.
And then he told me that the first thing that came to his mind after he got himself free was the boilers are going to explode because of the water hitting the boilers.
Sure.
And he said something about going to secure the boilers. And I did not know what that meant, but a lieutenant came to see me later on and said that he had to secure the boilers.
Okay.
Anyway, after he did that, he looked for an escape hatch. And he saw a light coming from somewhere. And when he saw that, he knew it was the way out from the engine room. So he yelled and said, if you can hear me, follow my voice, because I think I found the hatch. And he had a loud voice. Mike had a loud voice. Yeah. So he kept saying, over here, as he followed the light. And then when he got to where the light was coming from, there were a few men out there also. And he noticed that there were three guys who tried to get out, but they were having problem getting out, so he had to push them out so that he too could also go out, he said. He wanted to make sure that they get out. There was another guy that was there. He was not injured, he said. And I made him stay to help out with the evacuation. He did not give me any names.
Okay.
But the three guys that were badly injured, he noticed. And I don't know if he had some help, but anyway, I pushed them out through that opening. And then when the three of them got out, he also got out.
Okay.
But the other guy who was not injured, there's one that was not injured, and I guess he helped get them out too. But he, Mike said he wanted to make sure that this guy who was not injured is not going to go ahead of the others. So he had to make him do it, make him help out in the evacuation process. And when he got to the, they got to a deck outside the, out of the engine room, he was so stunned to see that the forward section of the ship was gone, or the part of the half of the airman's was no longer there, and on their side was the Melbourne.
Okay.
But he was suffering at the time. That's when he first noticed how bad the pain was, and he could not stand it anymore. He laid down. People offered to help him, but he said no, because just a mere touch of his skin was excruciating pain.
Oh, yes.
And while he was lying down there, he saw some ladder that was thrown to the Evans deck from the Melbourne. And he was still thinking that the other half of the Evans was going to sink. So he darted for the ladder and climbed up to the Melbourne.
Okay.
And when he reached the Melbourne deck, he collapsed, he said.
Gosh.
And they gave him pain shots, but none relieved him at all. So they airlifted him to the USS Kearsarge. And then at the USS Kearsarge, they could not help him either. They airlifted him further to Cam Ranh Bay, South Vietnam, U.S. Air Force Hospital.
Okay. He must have been a fairly tough individual to survive all of that, and then also to climb up the rope ladder on the side of the Melbourne to get himself up to the deck. Either that or maybe his mind blocked some of the pain so that he could do that. But that's amazing.
Yes. Yes. That's amazing. But I think it's a way of survival, I think, that God gives us, that in situations like that, you have some strength to go on, to survive. It's an unusual strength.
So, you'd mentioned earlier that when he returned home, that he would have nightmares. Did he have nightmares like that for the rest of his life, or was that just for a few years?
Just a few years.
Okay. Okay. Did they stop once he was? Once he had retired from the Navy, or did they even stop before then?
Before
then, okay. Okay. So, did he talk about it much, did he talk about the collision much, after that point? For example, if any of your children asked about it, would he talk about it? Or if other people asked him about it, would he talk about it?
No, he would not talk about it unless somebody asked.
Okay. And then when people did ask him, did he go into a lot of detail, or was it fairly short?
Fairly short.
Okay. So he still had some difficulty talking about it then?
Yes.
Okay. At any time after the collision, did he try to get therapy or any kind of counseling?
They didn't give them any. I mean, he was not given.
Okay.
Given any psychological counseling that I know of. It was just physical therapy, and he also had ear surgery because he had a perforated eardrum.
Oh, wow.
was done in it was done at the Oakland Naval Hospital. He had hearing loss from that accident. They did surgery, but it was not very effective.
So he could only really hear out of one ear then?
Yes.
Oh, wow. So, with all the burns on his body, did those heal fairly well?
They healed, but it changed the color of his skin.
Okay.
And had some scars.
But he was able to walk again normally, and as far as doing everyday chores or tasks, he was back to normal. Okay.
But I also think that the steam that he had inhaled affected his lungs, although he was also having work in the boiler room. It was he was diagnosed later on with asbestosis.
Okay.
But as far as the collision was concerned, I think that the steam he had inhaled had also affected the lining of his the respiratory system.
Oh, I imagine so. I mean, superheated steam, and if you inhale that, I would imagine it would do damage. So, after he retired from the Navy, then what did he do?
Well, he stayed home for 1 year, rest, and then he went back to work. And this time he worked as a civilian at the he went to El Toro Marine Corps Air Station, Marine Corps in El Toro.
Okay.
Marine Corps Station.
Yeah, that's in the Los Angeles area.
No, it was in Orange County.
Oh, Orange County. Okay. Okay. So, what did he do out at El Toro?
He worked as a boiler mechanic.
Oh, okay. imagine that. So how long did he work there?
He worked there for 10 years.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And then he started having problems.
Uh-oh. What kind of problems?
He had breathing difficulty.
Okay.
And then he was having chest pain. He also had some chest pain.
Hmm.
So he went on something of a disability.
Okay. And then, and so did he do anything to kind of occupy his time, or?
Yes, he enjoyed gardening.
Okay.
He would grow vegetables and flowers in the backyard. That's relaxing for him, he said.
I imagine so, especially considering the sort of things that he had endured and experienced. Mm-hmm. That was probably therapeutic for him then.
So he was 55 when he went on disability.
Okay. Now at this time, I imagine that you were working as a nurse as well.
Yes.
Okay. Now, excuse me. When you worked as a nurse, were you working for the Navy, or were you a civilian nurse?
Civilian.
Okay. Okay. What hospital did you work in?
Well, when the accident happened, I was working at the El Cerrito Hospital in Long Beach.
Okay.
And I later on went to the Long Beach VA Medical Center in 1972.
Okay.
And I worked at the Long Beach VA Medical Center until 1997. So
okay.
I was there for 24 years.
Oh, wow. I imagine working at the VA center, you saw a lot of people who had injuries like your husband's, and some that were even worse.
They, at the VA, at the section where I worked, we did not have any burn cases.
Okay.
It was mostly, I work in different areas in the hospital. I work with heart patients, rehab patients,
okay.
Surgical patients, heart patients.
Well, having a husband who was in the service and who had been injured, I imagine that you had kind of a different perspective when it came to working with servicemen in the hospital.
Well, I love the VA patients because my husband was a veteran. I did my best. I wanted to have them the best of care. They're veterans.
Sure. So, out of your children, what did they end up doing?
Well, my oldest is an RN.
Okay.
My second is she graduated from Cal State Northridge Telecommunications.
Okay.
Worked for Disney as a director in something about it was a movie. She was a promotion director for movies.
Okay.
And that's Disney movies.
Okay.
And my third one went into hotel management, and she was a director, and later on, assistant manager at DoubleTree Hotel.
Okay.
She worked mostly for the Hilton. And then the third one, that's Mark, the youngest boy. He graduated at DeVry University.
Okay.
And is in computer.
Okay. So the oldest one followed in your footsteps.
Yes.
And went into nursing. Okay.
Yes.
So did he ever talk about the collision with the children, or did he wait till they were much older, or did they even ever really ask him about it?
Well, the children heard about it, the first three, because they were old enough to understand, I believe, or at least know what was going on after the accident. He talked to them about it, all of us.
Okay.
But the youngest one, Mark, he did not know anything about the collision. But we had this plaque that was given by the city of Long Beach, which tells about 74 that were missing. And I have had that on the wall for many years.
Okay.
Together with some retirement pictures of Mike that was taken at the naval station in Long Beach when he retired.
Okay.
So it was like sort of a decor.
Okay.
And then when Mark was at the University of San Diego, he had a friend who had a friend that was home and that had come home for vacation from the Naval Academy.
Okay.
And he talked about the Naval Academy and how their training was, and he mentioned something about the Frankie Evans collision, and they have that as a training video.
Oh, and wow.
And Mark was listening to this guy, and he said, "Frankie Evans, that sounds familiar," he said. He was trying to think where he had seen that word, that name before, or heard that name before. And then he said, "I think it was one of the plaques that was a decor in my house, in our house." So when he came home on the weekend, he asked us about Frankie Evans. He said that there is a guy from the Naval Academy that was talking about the Frankie Evans collision with an aircraft carrier, Melbourne. And then he asked us, so, if we know something about it. And I said, yeah. I said that your dad was on that ship, USS Frankie Evans. And then he asked Mike, what was it, or what happened? And that's when Mike told him. And that was the time Mark learned about it. And he was already in college at that time.
Oh, wow. So he was much older before he heard about it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because Mark was born after the collision.
Yes.
A year after the collision.
That's amazing that he would spend all of his life and not really hear about it from his father. And then, mm-hmm. you know, he gets... He gets that information from a friend of his.
Yes. And I was surprised when he told us about it. And I said, yeah, I told him, Daddy was on that ship and it collided.
Oh, wow.
He was surprised, a big surprise for him.
Oh, that was his reaction, was just kind of stunned, or?
Yeah, he was, he just, like, he had to stop and think.
So at that time, did his dad fill him in on the details?
Yes, he told him. He told him about the 74 that died, and of course, one of them was in the engine room.
Mm-hmm.
That's the son of Chief Riley.
Yes.
And he had told us, he really felt guilty a little bit about Chief Riley's son, that because I think Larry Jr. was in one section, and then Mike said that he had to move him to the other section because somebody was on emergency leave, and he needed somebody that had the knowledge to take care of that section. And it was Larry Jr. that knew what he had the knowledge to be in that section.
Oh, wow.
And so he assigned him there. And then I think that's what was the part of that was the area that was also affected by the collision. And he perished. And he was saying, if I didn't put him there, he may not have died. He felt guilty. I kept telling him, it's an accident. You didn't know that this is going to happen.
Well, no, I mean, he couldn't know. Did he ever talk to Chief Riley about it after the collision?
Oh, yes. And, yeah, he did. And he said, I'm sorry. But accidents happen. He did not know.
Sure. And I understand that your husband died in 2000?
Yes.
Okay. And what had happened?
He died of respiratory failure.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and he had been diagnosed as having asbestosis.
Mm.
Later on, after he got out of the Navy, because he was always having this breathing difficulty, and he would go to the doctor, and then his lungs would collapse.
Oh.
Yeah, he had the collapse, and then they tried to treat him with medications and so forth. He even had a tracheostomy done.
Oh, wow.
And they had to open up his throat to get in order for him to be given breathing treatment. And so he had that tracheostomy, and his lung kept on collapsing.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to have surgery done also. 6 months before his death, he had a thoracotomy done, which is they removed some of the asbestotic plugs from his lungs. And he lived for 6 more months after the surgery. And then one morning, he was sometime in February, I think February 1st, he had a fever. He was having difficulty breathing. I took taken by ambulance to the hospital. They did what they could, but anyway, he died of respiratory failure.
Oh, wow.
And it's related to the asbestosis that he had from the Navy.
And I imagine that that all that superheated steam that he inhaled didn't help things either.
Yeah. I'm sure that it had aggravated the asbestosis problem.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Everything difficult.
Wow. Well, I thank you very much. I thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me.
You're welcome.
And I'm glad to know that your son is also taking an interest in not only his father's service in the Navy, but also the Evans itself.
Yes, he had been to the reunion, I think, a couple of times. He went to Lubbock, Texas that year. So that they had it over there, and he had gone to the archive.
And your daughters, have they taken any kind of interest in it?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. They all did eventually, especially Valerie, the youngest girl. She was the one that gave me that scrapbook where I had put my collection.
Okay.
She gave it to my husband on Father's Day in 1997, I think.
Okay.
And that's where I eventually put all those newspaper clippings about the Evans, and that ended up in the archive.
Okay.
Yeah. See, Valerie was the one that got really more interested in the collections.
Okay. Oh, wow. Well, it's good that they're able to do that, because it helps keep their father's memory alive.
Yeah.
Well, I thank you again for taking time out of your morning to talk to me. And I wish you all the best.
Well, thank you. That did well. Well, it was nice talking with you.
It was a pleasure to talk to you as well.
Thank you.
Well, have a good morning.
You have a good day, too. Hope to see you sometime in one of the reunions.
Oh, same here.
Okay.
Have a good one.
Okay. Good.
All right.